This episode of Beyond the Uniform is sponsored by Storybox. People trust each other more than they trust advertising. Storybox provides companies with the tools they need to take the best things their customers are saying and use these testimonials to drive more sales and referrals. You can find out if Storybox is right for you at StoryboxLite.com. If you employ a veteran, we'll also give you a 10% discount. That's StoryboxLite, L-I-T-E.com. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Assiri, and each week I interview a military veteran about their civilian career. My goal is to give active duty members of the armed forces and transition veterans ideas of all the different careers out there for which they're really well suited and advice on how to get there. Today is episode number 117 with Jim Besterman.
I'm not sure that I'm the best at necessarily starting a business from scratch, figuring out a business model in my garage, making this thing work, and taking all the risks there are in a startup phase. But I was pretty darn sure that I could take an existing business that had profits and cash flows and a infrastructure and a business model and all that stuff and make it a lot better.
Well, I'm excited for today's episode for a couple reasons. First of all, when I was at Stanford Business School, the entire time I was there, most of the time I was there, I thought I would actually do an entrepreneurial vehicle called Search Funds, which is looking for, finding a company, raising money to buy a company that's already doing well, and then helping it get to the next stage. And my guest today, Jim, that's exactly what he did. So the top three reasons to listen to today's show is, first of all, perspective. Jim is one of the only people I've ever had on the show who had a career before the Marine Corps. I think he gives a pretty good perspective of the before and after from the military. Second is search funds. He talks about the three different phases of a search fund and what his journey has been like and why many veterans might find this even more appealing than trying to come up with an original idea and start their own company. And then third is balance. One thing I admire about Jim is he used 5 vacation days and nights and weekends to raise money for his search fund. I love that idea of not just diving in recklessly, but really working around the clock and filling in those nooks and crannies to use that time to progress your career. And I think Jim's got some great advice on that. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find the show notes, you'll find links to everything we discuss in this episode. You'll also find out a lot of other great episodes as well. Lastly, if you haven't had a chance yet to give us a review on iTunes, please take a moment to do that. It does help get the word out about the show. So with that, let's dive in to my interview with Jim Besterman. Joining me today in Houston, Texas, is Jim Besterman. Jim, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you very much for having me.
So for listeners, I wanted to provide a quick overview on Jim's background. He's the CEO of Raptor Technologies, which is the nation's leading provider of integrated safety technologies for K-12 schools. He got his undergraduate degree at Amherst College, after which he worked at both the Monitor Group and for a software startup. He deferred his MBA to join the Marine Corps as part of the 3rd Force Recon Company. After he got his MBA from Wharton, he started an entrepreneurial vehicle called a search fund, which we'll get into, called Liberty Place Capital. Liberty Place Capital ultimately purchased Raptor Technologies in 2012, and he's been running the company for 5 years. So, Jim, you know, your story is a little bit different than most. Most of the people I talked to went into the military and then got out, and that was their very first job search. But I thought maybe we could actually start with coming from industry, what led you to join the Marine Corps?
So, you know, I looked into joining the military in college, and I didn't come from a military family, and I didn't know a whole lot about it. You know, my dream someday was to do, you know, special operations. And when I called a recruiter at the time, either they said this explicitly or I just inferred this, that basically you have to, if you join the military and in particular do special operations, you have to do it for the rest of your life. And, you know, knowing what I know now, that's not true. But at the time, I thought that that was the case. And I realized, I felt it's not something that I want to do for the rest of my life. I'd like to make it a part of my life, but not the rest of my life. And so I just put it on the back burner in my mind. And then I was maybe 5 or 6 years out of undergrad, working for a consulting firm, and I happened to be going home for Thanksgiving with a friend of mine from my hometown, and he said, "You know what? I just joined the Marine Corps Reserves." And I said, "Oh, really? Tell me about that." And he started to tell me that, you know, you do all, in the Marine Corps, do all your active duty training with the active duty guys, and then you get, eventually get cut to the reserves, and it's not the rest of your life. So I realized this is an opportunity. Eventually, I'm going to get too old to do this, so let me look into this and see if I can make this a part of my life, but not the rest of my life. So I looked into it, figured the whole thing out, and waited for the right time for me. I didn't want to just quit my job, join the military, come out and have to get a job. But I knew, you know, everyone in business school has kind of the platform laid out for them to find a new job in their career. So I waited until I got into business school. And when I got into business school, I deferred. Then I actually enlisted in the Marine Corps, made it into Force Recon. And about 16 months later or so, I got cut to the reserves. And I started Wharton for my MBA. At that point, it was 2003, so things were heating up a little bit, and then kind of after one semester in my MBA, I ended up getting called out of the reserves to do a tour in Iraq, OIF-1, or OIF-2, and so took a year off essentially from business school, did a tour in Iraq, came back, rejoined business school, and then finished up with everybody else, and again, you know, the opportunity was laid out there to get a job, just like everyone else was switching jobs in business school. So definitely a little bit of a different track.
Yeah. I was just going to say that it's so different where you had all of this, you know, I hate the word real world, but you had this business experience before the military. You had the intention of going to business school before the military. And so it seems like that was, an interesting kind of, chunk of your life where you're able to get a different set of experiences, but it seemed like the intention all along was to eventually go to business school and then start some sort of other careers. Is that right?
That's right. Okay. I thought about going to business school for a long time. Thought about both the military and business school for a long time, so I just was waiting for the right times.
That's awesome. And I'm really excited to speak with you because you're doing this thing called a search fund, which I know we'll get into. But before we get into some specific questions, how would you describe what a search fund is to a veteran audience?
Sure. So a search fund is a private equity vehicle. The difference between a regular private equity fund and a search fund is that a regular private equity fund basically goes out and buys a dozen companies and doesn't run any of them. A search fund only buys one company and runs it. So basically, in a search fund, you're looking for someone who wants to usually retire, and you're going to buy that company, let them retire, and then you become the CEO of that company. You can do it as a single individual or in pairs. But that's the key difference. You're only buying one company. Now, the investors in the search fund world, you know, if you invest in a private equity fund, that private equity fund diversifies itself. It buys a dozen companies. What happens in the search fund world is the investors generally will invest in a dozen or two dozen different individuals or teams that are running these search funds, and they build their own portfolio of deals by investing in single companies at a time. So they still get the diversification of a portfolio, but you, as what they call us search fund entrepreneurs, you as a search fund entrepreneur get to run your own business, which of course you don't go into search funds if you don't want to run your own business.
And what was it that initially attracted you to the search fund model?
So I sat back when I felt that it was the right time in my life, when I had enough of the experiences I wanted before I went off on my own. I kind of sat back, and in my mind, I'd always thought that an entrepreneur is someone who, you know, starts a business in their garage and builds it from there. But after business school, I ended up hearing about search funds, and again, they call us search fund entrepreneurs, and they talk about entrepreneurship through acquisition. And I kind of looked at myself and my strengths, and I thought, I'm not sure that I'm the best at necessarily starting a business from scratch, figuring out a business model in my garage, making this thing work, and taking all the risks there are in a startup phase. But I was pretty darn sure that I could take an existing business that had profits and cash flows and a infrastructure and a business model and all that stuff and make it a lot better. So I kind of went through in my mind, talked to a few friends that were on the search fund side, talked to a few friends who were on the start from scratch side, and figured out, you know, I'm pretty sure that the search fund model is the best one for me at this time, at that time in my life. Today, perhaps maybe I could start a business from scratch, but at that time in my life, the search fund model was really for me. I felt that that's where my strengths could play out the best.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, almost all of my time at business school, I had assumed I was going to go on to search funds. And similar to you, I think what attracted it to me was I wanted to run something and I had no idea. I didn't have an idea for what I wanted to start. And I think a lot of people, especially vets, feel that way, where it's like, I have the desire to lead a team and run a business, but I just don't know what that's going to be. And I liked that it seemed like a search fund was one of the fastest ways to be running a fairly sizable company. And from what I remember, you know, like you had said, you're usually purchasing these from someone who's wanting to sell, who's maybe a little bit older. And it was described to me as kind of like sometimes these sleepy industries where it could be like a waste management company. It could be a tow truck driving company. It could be these sleepy industries where it doesn't necessarily attract other top tier MBA students to go and try and tackle this. So when you go in there, and this often entails, you know, you're in Houston, but I know a lot of search fund people end up in much more remote locations. And so sometimes you end up in these remote locations and you're running a company and you've got a team of 20 or 25 people and it's an existing thing and you're just taking something that works and making it better. And I think it's so well suited to the veteran skill set of leading, managing a team, finding ways to improve things, finding ways to grow things. And, you know, I'm curious to hear your experience in a little bit, but it seems a lot of it is kind of like blocking and tackling of just kind of basically figuring out what there are problems and how to move things incrementally forward, rather than like in a startup where it's generating an idea and trying to like grow something from nothing, which seems like a different skill set.
I think that's absolutely right. There's some overlap in the skill set, but there's a lot of differences. And, you know, I think the average veteran, and I think probably the average business school person is probably better suited to taking an existing business and building and growing and improving it, rather than necessarily being one of those few who can take something from scratch. And, you know, you can, the way search funds, where search funds focus are a little bit under the radar. So once one of the criteria that you look for is usually between what's 1.5 and 3.5 million in EBITDA. So that's basically 1.5 million to 3.5 million in operating profits being generated by this particular business. Because when you go into the 4, 5, and greater million in EBITDA range, you tend to run into real private equity firms who, you know, have to deploy their capital and are willing to pay a high price for those larger companies. At the same time, you don't look really below 1.5 million EBITDA because you're looking for an existing business that does generate cash flows enough to really let you hire great people and make strong investments and really grow the firm. So you're flying a little bit under the radar of regular private equity, but above the radar of, you know, a small mom and pop shop.
And, you know, one of the things I struggled with, I think this is probably the reason I didn't move forward with a search fund, is you had talked about this being a one or two person operation. And for whatever reason at the time, I really wanted to partner with someone else. And business school was a series of like dating other people and didn't find anyone that worked out. And so didn't want to go it alone and ended up doing a startup instead. And I'm wondering, for you, how did you view it as like finding a partner? And I'm assuming you went alone. So like kind of what went into that decision, as well as any advice you have for people about thinking about whether to partner or go solo?
Sure. So as you described, there's two ways. You either do it as a single individual, that's called a solo searcher, or as a pair. Generally, when you're a pair, you generally try to have complementary skills. So one guy's an investment banker and the other guy's a consultant, or one guy does operations and the other guy does finance or something like that. But you can go either of the two ways. You're absolutely right that you need to find, if you're going to have a partner, a business school is a great time because it's full of people that might fit this model. But one thing you really have to keep in mind is that it's a marriage, essentially. You're going to be with this person for a decade, so you better be very compatible. In my particular case, I was out of business school by the time I learned of search funds, and so I was in an environment that wasn't, you know, I was in a regular operating company and not an environment where it was full of people that may or might be potential partners for me. So that really reduced my opportunity to partner up. The second thing I think was I was a little bit older than probably the average searcher by the time I did this. So I had accumulated a series of experiences that were semi-complementary to each other. So I felt that I didn't have to necessarily fill my holes with a partner. And thirdly, you know, to be frank, at the end of the day, at the time in search funds, a single searcher and a team of searchers got the same amount of equity in the deal. And I figured, you know, I'd love all the equity for myself. But at the end of the day, there are downsides to being a solo searcher. When you're a solo searcher during the search phase, which can last, you know, 2 to 3 years, it's really a rough time of looking at thousands and thousands of potential deals and narrowing it down and really running every piece of the process yourself, from deal flow to diligence to closing the deal. And that's difficult as a solo searcher because one thing that tends to happen is if you get a deal under LOI, letter of intent, and you're moving toward closing, what generally happens is you can't be closing on the deal and doing all the proper diligence and keeping a pipeline of new deals flowing at the same time. So what generally ends up happening, and it certainly happened to me, is your pipeline tends to dry up of new deals. So then if that particular deal falls apart, and a lot of deals fall apart in the diligence process, then you're left going back to the search with a dry pipeline that you then have to build up again. And then, at least happened to me, it happens again. You get deep into a deal, your pipeline dries up, that deal explodes, and you have to go back to scratch. Whereas if you are in a partnership and you're disciplined, you can have one guy digging deeply into diligence on a particular deal and the other person making sure that you've got a pipeline flowing and full in case that deal falls apart. So there are certainly advantages in the search phase to a partnership. And post-acquisition, there are certainly advantages, especially if you're very complementary. But one thing that I would suggest and advise to solo searchers is once you complete the acquisition, you can always hire talent. You don't necessarily need to have a partner who's good at finance or good at operations or whatever it might be. You can always hire that talent. So post-acquisition, I think it makes less of a difference. During the search, it certainly makes a big difference and a positive difference to have a partner.
That's great, man. I think that's a very, very balanced breakdown on the kind of the pros and cons of it. And I wanted to kind of step through your experience, but let me just start by the way that I understand this is it seems like there's kind of three chunks, and I figured we could maybe take them one at a time. But correct me if I'm wrong. It seems like there's a phase of an initial phase of fundraising where you're finding people who are going to do two things. First, they're going to pay your salary for up to 2 or 3 years to find the right company. They're betting on you. And then they're also saying that, like, hey, if the deal is great, they're going to follow on and have the option to invest to give you the capital to buy that company. So, like, it seems like phase one is fundraising. Phase two is this search phase where you're looking for that company. And then phase three is when you find it, you purchase it, and now you're operating and trying to grow and maybe ultimately sell or take that company somewhere great. So before we maybe dive into those pieces, is that fundamentally kind of like the three phases in your mind, or is there anything I'm missing?
No, that's exactly right. So unlike a regular private equity firm, which raises $100 million, $500 million, $1 billion, they're going to go out and deploy that money over a series of deals. However, in the search fund world, you're only doing one deal. You know that the deal size will be maybe 10 to 30 million on average deal size, but you don't know if it's going to be 10, and you don't know if it's going to be 30. So you can't really raise that money up front like a private equity firm that knows it can do a dozen deals and just make sure that it has enough equity at the last deal to do that deal. You can't do that in a search fund. So what exactly as you described, the first phase is raising the search capital. For a single individual, that's maybe $400,000 to $500,000. For a team, it's somewhere between $500,000 and $750,000. The bulk of that expense is really to pay you a salary during that time to keep you alive. You're not getting a CEO salary or anything like that, but it's a salary enough to let you live a normal life. The rest of that money goes toward search expenses, an office, travel, research, all of that stuff. And then when you run out of money, you run out of money. So you're incented to make sure you don't overspend during that search phase, but you're expected to find a deal sometime in that while that money lasts, which is generally kind of between 2 and 3 years. Once you find the deal, well then, and you get all it done to close that deal, well then you'll know the exact equity size, right? There'll be the valuation of the deal. You'll be able to put some debt on it, maybe some seller debt on it, and the rest will be equity. So then what you do is you go to your investor group, and they get two rights. For having invested in the search phase of it, they get two rights. The first is a right of first refusal on a pro rata equity share of that deal. So to put a simplified example, say it's a $20 million deal and you have $10 million in debt and you need $10 million in equity, and say you had 10 investors, each of which had the same amount in your search, well then each of them would get a right of first refusal on $1 million equity check in that deal. So a right of first refusal on a pro rata equity share of that deal. You give it out to them, they get the right of first refusal, so they can say, no, I don't like it, and not give you that money, but hopefully you have some backup equity options and things like that, and you try to raise that equity and get that deal done. So that's their first right for having funded you for that search phase. Their second right for having funded you for that search phase is what's called a 50% step up on the search capital. So say you raise $500,000 to cover the costs of your search, they get a 50% step up on that search capital. So that $500,000 turns into $750,000, and that money, whether you have a single dollar of it left or $100,000 left, that money goes into the deal as equity. So it just basically, normally you're doing a $10, $20, $30 million enterprise value transaction, so it doesn't really move the needle too much, but it does go into the deal, and they do essentially get that equity return to them eventually post-deal. So that's how it works, and generally you don't raise any money post-acquisition, so you raise the money for the acquisition post-acquisition. Generally you work from cash flow or debt.
And so let's start with that first phase then. How did you go about raising money? And in particular, how much did you raise for the search phase? And I'm curious, like, around, if you're comfortable sharing, how much you raised, how long it took, and just how you approached going around with, you know, asking for money.
Sure. So I learned about search funds, I think, in the year 2008. About that time, I felt like I was coming to the point where I was ready to go off on my own. And then I thought about entrepreneurship from scratch versus entrepreneurship through acquisition, and realized I wanted to go the search fund route. And so that was back in 2009. At 2009, it was kind of, you might remember, dark times for raising money because of the financial crash. So at the time, I had a job. So what I did, the first step in the search fundraising process is to write what's called a private placement memorandum, a PPM. And so basically this PPM lays out two things, one of which you lay out the basic parameters for your search fund. Now, generally what the investors are looking for is to make sure that you understand what search funds are, so they're making sure that you're laying it out properly. And then the second piece of it is basically about yourself. Why are you the proper person to successfully complete each phase of the search fund process, from the searching to the acquisition to the operations post-acquisition, then to the eventual sale? So that's what's contained in this private placement memorandum, this PPM. So I decided I was going to go down the search fund route. You know, some people burn their ships at the shore and quit their job and go around fundraising. It was dark times in 2009, so I decided I'm not going to burn my ships at the shore. I'm going to write my PPM on nights and weekends and then take some vacation days and see if I can raise the money. So that's what I did. I took some vacation days. I actually was able to do it, I think, in five vacation days and kind of go around the country to the what we call the usual suspects in the search fund world, people who have done 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 of these search fund investments. And the way it works is first you basically cold send them this PPM. So you figure out their name, you figure out their email, and you just email it to them. They actually like investing in search funds, the people you're generally talking to, so they're happy to read it. If they like you, generally, then they give you an interview. And then if they like you in the interview, generally they check references and then write you a check. I'll just tell kind of a funny story. You know, I had a job and I was just doing this on vacation days. So I decided I'm going to break up the country into geographic regions, and my first region was in Southern California. So I sent my PPM out to a couple investors in Southern California, and crickets. You know, I didn't hear anything back. And so I decided, okay, I don't know exactly how this works, but I'm going to, you know, cold call these guys. And so I cold called the first one, and I said, you know, my name is Jim Vesterman. I sent you my PPM. He said, you know, he was a little bit gruff on the phone. Oh, yeah, I saw it come through. I haven't had time to read it. Yeah, I'll read it. And then he basically hangs up the phone. And I thought, you know, that's not a great start to my fundraising process. But the next day, I get an email from this guy, and he said, I'm very impressed by your PPM. Where do I send the check? So that was my first investor. It was a guy who didn't even meet me, didn't even have a conversation with me, and just asked me where to send the check. Now, that's unusual. Everybody else met me, interviewed me, checked references, things like that. But that was my first investor.
Unexpected, man.
So I ended up raising about $400,000 for my initial search that lasted me a little over 2 years. And I'll get to it, but I ended up running out of money, and we can talk more about that. And I ended up raising about another $90,000 or so to extend my search. But if you'd like to, I'll outline a little bit of the parameters of how you raise this money, if that's of interest.
Yeah, I think it'd be helpful just like, you know, basic advice that you'd give to someone. So if a veteran's listening and they're liking this so far and they think that they're well suited for it, you know, any advice on how to go about that I think would be helpful.
Sure. So the best single piece of advice is that Stanford Graduate School of Business tracks search funds. So if you go to the Stanford Center for Entrepreneurial Studies, you'll find that they do a study on search funds every 2 years. And you can download that study, and that study will tell you everything I've told you and more, and has a lot of data on all of the search funds. So that's the single best source of information.
And for
that
listeners,
Center for Entrepreneurial Studies at Stanford also has.
Oh, I was going to say, for listeners, I'll add that as a link in the show notes so you can find that as well.
Great. That also has sample PPMs and other materials for potential searchers. But what you'll see in there is that generally what happens is you raise a certain number of units, what they call investor units. Generally, these investor units are around $30,000 or $35,000 or maybe $45,000 per unit. You determine, you know, what your total raise is. You divide it by the unit count and you get your unit size. So that's how you do it. You do it in investor units, usually $30,000 to $35,000, and you go out and you raise those investor units. Some investors take one unit, some take two, some take a half, but that's how you put together your initial search funds. And then once you have all the commitments to that, then you basically close on your search fund, you get that LLC created, and then you begin your search.
And so let's say then let's tackle the second phase then. I'm wondering What does the search look like? And I'm just so curious too, because it like entrepreneur, like, well, it is entrepreneurship, like startups though. It's just, it seems like you've got your entire day before you, and it's like, and no roadmap. So it's like, how did you go about, what did your day-to-day life look like, and how did you add structure to your day?
Sure. So you're basically starting a private equity fund from scratch, by yourself or in a pair, and doing absolutely everything yourself, which some people find greatly interesting. I found it greatly interesting. I really enjoyed it. But you're doing everything. You're negotiating the terms for the LLC agreement to close on the search fund. You're finding your office space. You're negotiating that lease. You're beginning the process of getting deal flow, which I can go, well, I'll go into more detail about that. Then you're doing the diligence, and you're hiring accounting diligence people, and you're reviewing the legal work and with lawyers, and all that stuff. So basically, you're doing every single piece of the process. Now, the most important piece of the process is really deal flow. There's generally two types of deal flow. One is through business brokers, and the other is what's called proprietary deal flow. Basically, the proprietary is where you pick an industry segment, and then you dig deep into the industry segment to find companies that might be in your size range, and then you reach out to them in various ways to try to get that owner to talk to you, see if they are in your size range, and then see if you can strike a deal. The broker route is, these are already brokers who have deals, and they will present you with deals in your size range, and you can, to some extent, those deals are already semi-prepped by the broker. And then oftentimes that's a competitive process to win that deal. And then if you win it, then you close on that deal and go to close.
And, you know, one thing I was also curious about is how did you, you know, I'm just thinking you have this relationship with investors, and you're going to need to come back to them and have them write another check. How did you kind of keep in contact and keep that relationship alive while you were doing this search?
Sure. I think there are a couple different approaches to that. Some, I actually invest in search fund myself, and some people create a, you know, a quarterly newsletter or something like that and communicate in that way to all investors, in addition to some phone calls and things like that. I went about it in a slightly different route. I could tell that some of the investors wanted periodic communications. Some only wanted to talk to you when you had a great deal. Others wanted to talk to you about all types of deals. So I basically gave them my annual financials. Every year I sent a formal set of annual financials regarding what funds were left in the spending and all of that in the search fund. But then I really kind of treated them as I thought they wanted to be treated. So the people that wanted to talk about every deal, I talked to them about every deal. The people that only want to talk about great deals, I only talked about great deals with them. And those who wanted just constant periodic, I checked in with them on their basis. So that's how I did it. That's only one approach. Another approach is to write a quarterly newsletter and keep statistics and send those out on a regular basis and things like that. And some people certainly pursue that path. And I think both ways work. But at the end of the day, you're going to need these investors to be on board with you when you find your final deal. So you do have to have that constant communication. You do have to let them get to know you over that search period, so they have more confidence or less confidence in supporting you at the actual time of acquisition.
And I imagine for you that paid off when you know, you came to that point where you had to raise more money. And so I'm wondering, how far were you into the search when you had to get an extension, and what was that like?
Yeah, so I actually had a deal lined up it was about months, probably about month 22 or so. I had a deal. I actually had all of the equity committed. So all my investors had said yes to their equity piece of it, those that were interested had said yes, and I had filled in the gaps for those that weren't. I had all the debt lined up from a bank. I had all the paperwork done from the lawyers, and basically all I had to do was sign on the line. But I had noticed, as each week marched toward close, that a few things weren't marching in the right direction. The projections that they had given me turned out to be pretty far overinflated. They had some customer concentration, which they said they were going to be able to negate with the addition of another big customer. That didn't happen, and they kept pushing it to the next week and pushing it to the next week, but at the time of close, it didn't happen. And so there were a few things that were going wrong with this deal. And so I decided, even though I had all of that lined up, that and I knew that I was probably 4 months away from running out of cash, that, you know, there's a saying in the private equity community, some of the best deals you've ever done are the deals you never did. And so I decided the right thing to do was walk away from that deal, even though I knew I was going to run out of cash. You can't find and close a deal in 4 months worth of cash. So I did walk away. A lot of the investors applauded me for walking away because I could have closed the deal. Now, not all those investors came into the extension, but the vast majority of my investors, when I went back, because I knew this is what I wanted to do, I knew I wanted to close on a deal, I knew I wanted to run a company. So I went back, asked for an extension that would take me another 9 or 10 months worth of cash. The vast majority of my investors came in. The ones that didn't come in, those units were taken up by other investors. So I raised that 9 or 10 months worth of cash. And then thankfully in that period of time, I found a couple other great deals, including Raptor Technologies, and I closed on Raptor. It was about a little over the 2.5 year mark total into the search.
And overall, how many companies did you place an offer on?
So at the top end of the funnel, I looked at thousands of companies, dug deeply into diligence in, only a dozen or so. Went to the altar twice. I also went to the altar with another company that I didn't mention, but the one I mentioned, and went to the altar with another company. That company had its own issues. And then finally closed on Raptor. So I was to the altar with two companies, you know, negotiating LOIs with probably a dozen companies, and partially into diligence with a dozen, and then as you go up the funnel, thousands at the cursory level.
And for a veteran audience, how would you describe the company that you purchased, Raptor Technologies?
So Raptor is a fantastic company. In my opinion, it's a fantastic example of a search fund acquisition. Our little niche is that we do what we're known for, at least, is visitor management software for K-12 schools. So if you look at America, there are about 130,000 schools in America if you add public plus private. The vast majority of those schools manage everyone coming in and out of the building with pencil and paper. It's very, 19th century. There's lots of problems signing in visitors, vendors, contractors, volunteers. There's lots of problems signing these people in with pencil and paper, not the least of which is you could write down my name and I could write down your name and they wouldn't know the difference. So what we do is we replace that pencil and paper log with an electronic log. We do that by actually scanning in a government-issued ID, military IDs, driver's licenses, things like that. We scan in a government-issued ID. It captures your real name. We actually have the ability to pull the picture off the ID. It records the date, the time, where you went, all of that stuff. And now the school has an electronic log of everyone coming in and out. Because it's electronic, it actually allows us to do a couple things, including an instant sex offender background check. And these days, we flag about 35 registered sex offenders every single day attempting to enter our client schools.
Wow, that's crazy.
It's amazing. And the second check we do is against a custom database where they can put anything they want into the custom database. Most districts put in custody issues, so basically who can pick up whom, because as you might imagine, that's kind of overwhelming these days to schools. So those are the two instant checks that we do, and we issue about 100 of those a day on the custody side. And then we do a lot of other things that we're a little less well known for. We track volunteer hours, we track student tardies, things like that. But basically, we help improve school safety at the most basic level for schools across the country. Today, we serve about 17,000 schools in all lower 48 states.
And in running, you've run this for 5 years now. I'm just wondering, how has the company changed in those 5 years?
It's changed a good amount. So The founder had founded it, ran it for about 10 years, and had built up the leading market share at the time, which was 7,000 schools. So in the past 5 years, we've gone from 7,000 to 17,000 schools. So now basically you can take every other visitor management provider to K-12 schools in the country, add them all together, and we serve more schools than all of them combined. So we've grown a lot. The team has grown a lot. When I acquired the company, there were 12 people at Raptor. Now we have 50 people. We've done a lot of big projects. We actually have rewritten the software from scratch. That took us over 2 years, but we're rolling that out actually this Sunday, officially. We've written an entire, we're a couple months away from finishing an entire new application that helps schools with emergency management, basically moving from pencil and paper for emergency management to electronically managing emergencies. So we've done a lot over these last 5 years and just built a great team and a great set of customers across the country.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask about, I always like to ask about failure just because I think it's the juice of where we learn everything. And so I'm just wondering whether it's running the company or in the search phase, what's one of the bigger mistakes that you've made and what did you learn from that?
Sure. So let's see. In the search phase, the single biggest mistake I made was what I alluded to before. In particular, with one of the deals that I didn't mention, I found a great deal. It was probably week three of my search. I was still pretty new to the whole process, and it was a great, interesting company, and I just dug in, and it took me, you know, a month and a half to get them under LOI, letter of intent. I finally got them under LOI, and then I dug into diligence and ended up uncovering a lot of problems with the financials and things like that. Long and short of it was I ended up spending a lot of time on that first deal such that my pipeline dried up. Then that deal, you know, I found enough problems in the financials that it fell apart for a few months. So then I had to start building my pipeline back up again. And then it, you know, revived its head. And so then I jumped back into that deal because I loved it so much and spent a couple months trying to make it happen. And then my pipeline dried up. It fell apart again. No pipeline. And I did that three times, essentially. So my single biggest mistake was spending months and months and months knee-deep in this particular deal and letting my pipeline dry up each time. And that was, you know, one of the reasons why I ended up, I think, burning through my cash because I had spent so much time on that one particular deal. It was a great deal, fantastic deal, and I was a little, I think, green in terms of my approach to it. I should have been much more disciplined about cutting it off early and keep trying to keep my pipeline moving at the same time because, as I've said, that's the single hardest thing for solo searchers.
Looking at your background, I could see, you know, the experience in the military, out of the military, and then at business school. I just imagine all of these things combining to make you really well suited for a search fund. And I'm wondering, you know, if a veteran listening, let's say the person's on active duty and they're thinking of going this search fund route, what advice would you have for them for kind of what are the table stakes here? What are the skills they need to acquire leaving the military before starting a search fund?
So I would say a couple things about that. One is it is not unknown, but it is uncommon to raise a search fund without an MBA. Again, it has been done without an MBA, but it's uncommon. So if you're very interested in this route, it is much more common to have come from a business school before you raise a search fund. So I think that's almost basic table stakes. The second is that I think one important component in this, which you don't get in the military, you get a lot of great things out of the military in terms of leadership, teamwork, and running an organization, but you don't get a lot of finance. And it is important. There's a lot of elements within the search fund search phase, the acquisition phase, and the operational phase that have to do with running the numbers of the company, managing the numbers of the company, running the numbers, reporting on those numbers, and getting all of that right. It's a very important element. So that's one thing that business school can do for you. If you do think about running a search fund, take as many finance classes as you can, accounting classes as you can, so you make sure that you are as strong as you can be on that front, or find a partner who has a finance background, a private equity background, an investment banking background, something like that, and they can pull that piece of the load. But those are a couple things I'd say for active duty military.
One last question I'd have before I turn things over for you is, what are the downsides of a search fund? Like, is there anything that a veteran should be aware of in kind of setting off on this particular entrepreneurial vehicle?
There are a few downsides. One is you generally can't be very geographically constrained. That is to say, you'll choose a place to search from. I search from Philadelphia, but you generally can't do what's called a geographic search, saying, I want to live in Philadelphia, so I'm only going to look at firms in Philadelphia. You can't do that because you're really obligated, and it's in your best interest to find the best company in that particular niche that you can potentially close on. And that company might be in Houston, that company might be in San Francisco, and it might be in Philadelphia. So one of the downsides, in particular if you have a family, is that you may find a deal in Houston and have to move to Houston or San Francisco or Omaha. Now, you do have discretion to say, I'm not going to be doing a deal in Omaha, but basically you have to be able to accept moving to any real city or town to live based on where the headquarters of that company is. So that is a real downside. I will say that the search phase is a particularly grueling phase. That's, I love my Marine Corps experience for testing my perseverance, but it's a real test of perseverance. Because in particular, if you're a solo searcher who doesn't have someone to complain to, you really fall in love with these deals and you envision yourself running this company, and then the deal falls apart. And that's pretty depressing. And then you do it again, and the deal falls apart again, and you get depressed again, and it happens over and over. And people in the search fund community talk about it as an emotional roller coaster, and it very much is. But if you can get through that period and find a great deal, of course, there's nothing better than running your own company and building and growing a profitable platform and hiring people and hiring great people. It's fantastic. So it's a lot of fun. But there are a couple downsides to the search fund side. And I will say that, as it says in the Stanford study on this, approximately 20% of searches fail to close on a deal. That is to say, they successfully raise a search fund, they search until their money runs out, and they don't close on a deal. So 20% of those that search don't close on a deal. If that happens, the upside to it is that you can shake hands and walk away from the investors, so you don't owe anyone anything, but you're then, have to go off and find a job and not be able to fulfill your dream on that front. So that's definitely a downside as well.
That's great. And also congratulations to you. I can only imagine the tenacity and resilience it took to go through the fundraising and the search. And then I just imagine taking over this company, then it's like almost out of the fryer into the fire. You're kind of like in the thick of it then, of running this organization and growing it from, I think you said, from 50 to over 50 employees, which is just an incredible growth to contemplate. So it's really impressive to see what you've done. And I always like to reserve the last couple minutes just to turn things over to you and just say, knowing that you have an audience of active duty members of the military and veterans listening, what other advice would you have for them? It could be personal, it could be professional, but what else would you want to say to them?
What I think I'd say is, one thing I left out in my career was I ended up taking a year off. After doing consulting for 4 years, I ended up taking a year off and living in Italy. It was a fantastic year. But one of the things that I did there was I sat back and thought about what I wanted to do someday, what I thought I was good at, what I thought I was not good at, what I didn't like, and what I did like. And taking the time to contemplate that, it's very hard. It's very hard. It's a lot easier when you're taking a year off in Europe. It's very hard in daily life to take that time, but I would strongly recommend that you find a way to get away and do that contemplation and figure out what you want to do someday based on your strengths and your interests and avoiding your weaknesses and your non-interests. And really think that through. And if you come out with something like, I knew that I realized that I wanted to take my own company, build and grow that company, that I wasn't made for the advisory side of the world, i.e. investment banking or consulting. I wasn't made for that. I was made for these other things, and that's what I enjoyed. So once I had that in my mind and knew that, I also was in no rush to get there, so I put in place specific experiences, and I would also recommend that. You don't have to do it the next day once you figure out what you want to do. You can create stepping stones and get those proper experiences so that when you do what you feel you're destined to do or want to do, that you're prepared for that. So I would highly recommend finding a way to step away and contemplate what it is you're good at, what you're not good at, what it is you want to do someday. And then I also wouldn't rush it to get there. There's no rush. And I think it does pay dividends to be prepared in your experiences before you actually jump in my opinion.
I love it. I think it's so difficult to do, but I know that that rings true in my own life of just always, you know, especially right out of the military, just feeling in a rush to get on with things and a rush to go to the next thing. And then out of business school, a rush to get on to things. And it's so valuable to take that deep breath and take a step back and get perspective. And, you know, my wife is fond of saying it takes time to save time. And it's true where if you can take that step back and get a little bit of perspective, it might cause you to choose a very different route. Or as my captain on our submarine would say, you know, like early on, a few degree course change will save you a dramatic shift down the road. And it's true. If you're able to take a step back and look and see of the minor things that you can do today to avoid a major change down the road, it's so crucial. But in order to do that, it seems like you have to take a little step back. You have to take a little time away to get that vantage point.
You know, they used to say in recon, slow is smooth, smooth is fast. And I think that's all pointing to the same thing. It does pay to take it a little bit slow in order to move fast.
I love it. Well, Jim, I appreciate your time. I can only imagine how busy things are running your growing organization, but I appreciate your sharing your story and also just filling in the community about search funds and the opportunity this presents for veterans. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Surface.
All right. Well, that's all. Thanks for listening to Jim's interview. I hope that you're piqued your curiosity about entrepreneurship or search funds, or maybe even just ruled this out, which is just as good as finding what you want to do is closing some of those doors on things that you don't want to. Couple last plugs. First of all, if you haven't already signed up for an Audible free trial, you get a free audiobook of your choice if you go to beyondtheuniform.io/books. Great way to use no extra time or net time to knock out some of the books that have been recommended on the show. Second, if you haven't signed up for our newsletter, if you go to beyondtheuniform.io/newsletter, definitely do that. It's the primary form that I use to communicate with the audience. And with that, we'll be back next week with more interviews with military veterans about their civilian career. Thanks.